Okay, some technical difficulties there, but that's fine. You know, it actually even gave me a chance to go to sleep and wake up in the morning, and now I'm more refreshed. So, and we see everything relates to everything. You see technology and business and everything like that. But one of the things we get from history is the understanding, the ability to see things from different perspectives. And write this in your notes. Write it. You know, when we learn to be more forgiving of others and of ourselves when we see the issues involved in everything, even with these recordings. You know, I grade the notebook at the very end, but I ask you to submit them weekly, these lecture notes, or try to, because otherwise I'm setting you up for failure. And it's like that debt slavery thing we talked about in Athens, where once you fall into that downward spiral, those farmers weren't going bankrupt immediately. It might be 2 or 3 years down the line, but it is inevitable once you fall into it, you're never going to get out of it. You're never going to be able to catch up financially. And here, even though it's not to that extreme, you would be able to catch up. If people just left these notes till the very end, they'd be trying to catch up when they have trouble doing, say, 5 hours of notes per week. How are they going to do 25 or 30 hours of notes at the very last week? When you look here on your computers, and by the way, computers, a computer used to be the name of a job that people had. People would do this computation. So you were a secretary, you were a computer, you were an accountant, just like that. But then they developed a machine to do this, and it was thought that, oh, okay, now, just like a manufacturing machine or whatever that was, essentially, like the Industrial Revolution, the machines could do it much faster and much more profitably. Now, what would be the biggest, most powerful computer company back in the day? Way, way back, you know, when computers were getting started, everything like that, and for a long time after that, when I was a kid, what was the biggest, most powerful, most important computer company in existence? It would be IBM. IBM. Now, you can tell just from the name. Okay, it's setting the standard for every computer company out there, really for business as a whole. So this is the standard. It's almost like the superheroes we talked about before. The what is to be looked up to? What is the ideal? The super thing. Well, you can tell from the name. International Business Machines. Like a calculator. It's for business. That's it. It's like a calculator. No fun or frivolity. You use it not when you're at home in leisure time, only if you have some sort of business. It was a square box. It was black and white. It was meant for business. Steve Jobs had a different idea, a revolutionary idea. Now, Steve Jobs is the co-founder of Apple, along with Steve Wozniak. And Steve Jobs says to himself, no, computers can revolutionize the world, can revolutionize how we live our lives. And there should be a computer in every household. And he names his computer company, ultimately he names it Apple. The complete opposite of what you would think of when you think of a computer. It's not black and white. It's not even just color. It's this red organic color in the shape. It's not a box. It's not even a sphere. It's not even a geometric shape. It doesn't have the angles or anything like that. It's an organic, alive shape. It's something living. It's something that grows. It's something that's sweet. Even beyond that, taken to an extreme, this is the forbidden fruit in the Garden of Eden. By the way, I was talking with one of you over the phone, And she was asking me about Catholicism specifically, about what is the truth and what to believe. And I was explaining at least a big part of it, if not a huge part of it, is a language and a translation. And even aside from translation, just language as a whole and misunderstandings. And for example, we know that it could not possibly have been an apple in the Garden of Eden, because apples didn't grow in that area. And we know why this occurred. When we look at the history, we see, apple was just a term for any fruit, because it's human nature. Once we see or have some idea in our head, rather than adding new things as being different, we try and fit whatever we see into the concept we already have. And indeed, you know, when we saw this fruit that looked like a pine cone, we called it a pineapple. You know, you see this over and over again. This hippias used to be the word for horse. Is the Greek word, the ancient Greek word for horse. And when they saw this unusual creature in the river, the word for river is potamus, and so they called it a hippopotamus, a river horse. And you see, even in day-to-day life, we do that all the time. We tend to fit things into what we believe and what we already know, rather than fitting our beliefs and knowledge into what we see, which is what we should really do. There's a lot of stuff we could get into here. But anyway, I should mention this, you know, right on the point with this, again, Catholicism and Christianity as a whole. Why is it called an Adam's apple? Why is that? Well, that's because, you know, men have this Adam's apple, and the story is consistent with this theme throughout history. Women can't be trusted. Women are devious. Women are this, that, bringing the man down. This story is, in the Eve, the first woman, took this fruit from the tree of knowledge and ate from it and gave it to Adam. And so she tempted him into something he wasn't supposed to do, and he ate from it, and that piece got stuck in his throat, and there's that bulge there, and that's why we had have an Adam's apple. That's why we have that bump there. Now, obviously, this is not true. The reason men have that bump there is because we have longer vocal cords. That's what makes our voices deeper. And so because our vocal cords are longer, we need more space in our throat to fit them in. So that's it. But anyway, here, this forbidden fruit, you know, but still, forbidden knowledge, very, very evocative, very tempting to people. It captivates them and definitely gets people's attention. Now, I make sure to remember anytime I explain this in a class, because I know what students will probably be thinking. Go your own way, be a rebel, do your own thing, and you'll succeed. No, that might be true, but if Steve Jobs had named it Satan's computing system or something like that, how many people would really buy it? Some of my students probably, but this is how smart Steve Jobs is. Yes, it is rebellious and forbidden and all these types of things, but it is also as American as apple pie, which, by the way, is not really American, but that's neither here nor there. And here, again, when you see highly skilled stuff, it's usually, I love to give like martial arts examples to show this, that one move will have like five different things that it's doing for you. Five different whatever, 10 different things. But anyway, here, Steve Jobs, not only is this a great captivating name and everything, not only is it as American as apple pie, but you also got to cover the business side of things. You also got to be smart and make that money. Steve Jobs, he had dropped out of school. Both those Steves, Wozniak and Jobs, dropped out of college. A lot of these internet billionaires did that. But anyway, they dropped out. Steve Jobs, he goes and gets a job working for Atari. Now, I don't know if you guys know, if I'm just too old or whatever it is, but Atari was this first, basically the first computer game system, like Nintendo or Sega, but it predated them. And so Atari came up in California, and Steve Jobs, he's really into computers, he goes there and insists on getting a job with them, and they hire him as a tech. And then when he goes off, he breaks off to start his own company, he understands, oh, this is another thing I should probably explain to you millennials. Back a million years ago when I was young, we didn't look numbers up with the internet, and the internet didn't even exist. And certainly iPhones and everything didn't exist. How would we get a phone number when we needed it? There were these huge books, gigantic books with very thin paper, but they were gigantic books called phone books. And when you needed to look up a person, it was in the white pages. And then there was another section for businesses. That's the yellow pages, where you looked up a business. And guess how these books are arranged? Alphabetically. So if you wanted a computer of some sort, you would go to the C section, okay, under computers, and then that section is all the sections under the sections are also alphabetical. Therefore, firstly, when he names his company something with an A, it shows up really early. So when anybody looks under computers, they're going to see the A names first. And by naming it Apple, it comes before but still close to Atari, which was popular at the time. So his new startup company, people go look for Atari right before they get to it, but right when they get to it, they're going to see Apple and say, hey, what's this? So Steve Jobs, he builds the company up more and more and more, builds it up really strong. And by the 1980s, you know, he's still a young guy, and he doesn't really understand the business world so well. So he gets other people to help run things and everything like that. He even lured this guy away from Pepsi. Scully was his name, saying to him, do you really want to sell sugar water for the rest of your life, or do you want to come change the world? Well, Scully came over. But they kept butting heads and everything like that, and he actually participated, along with the board of directors, in pushing Steve Jobs out of his own company. They kicked him out of his own company. It's not common, but it's not uncommon either, that this happens in business, because once it becomes a corporation, now other people own the company. They own the stock, they vote, everything like that, and you're responsible to them, and they can even kick you out of the company that you started. Well, they did that. And so he's got a lot of time on his hands, and what happens is he actually takes a vacation. He goes with his wife to Italy, and Italy is all about style. Lamborghinis, Italian suits, everything like that. Italians are famous for style. And as he and his wife are walking, he says, you know, I really like the stone in this sidewalk. I really like it. And Steve Jobs in particular is seen as being a genius when it comes to graphic design. Literally, that word genius is probably way overused. But here, no, this definitely applies to Steve Jobs when it comes to design. Now, Apple, over time, just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. It's going downhill, down the toilet, basically. And Apple finally says, oh, you know, Steve Jobs, come back. Steve Jobs had actually started some companies on his own, purchased an animation company. I know a couple of you are doing animation. He purchased it from George Lucas, and he changed the name to, I think it was a program used by the company, he changed the name from Lucasfilms Animation or something like that to Pixar. And now you guys all know of it because it did so many impressive things, Toy Story and Finding Nemo and everything like that. Anyway, I want Steve Jobs back. He comes back. He comes in, he says, he turns the company around, and they start doing really, really well. Extraordinarily well. Fine, company's making a lot of money. And he says, you know what? I think this is a bad idea that we're making all this stuff, but then we give it to the retailers to sell, and they don't understand the product properly. They're not going to be able to present it properly. And of course, they're getting so much of the profit. We should have our own retail stores. Now, this may seem to make sense. This may seem to even be obvious to you guys. Oh, you know, why wouldn't you make all this money yourself? Why do you need all these stores? Well, you need to look at the context, which is to say you need to look at the history. Firstly, just before this, another huge computer company called Gateway. Gateway had tried to, instead of just producing the computers, actually have its own stores. It failed completely, disastrously bad. Another computer company, a different one, this one you probably have heard of, Dell. Dell said, we're not going to sell them in the stores at all. We're just going to sell direct to the consumer, mail it to the consumer. That seemed to do well. So here's Steve Jobs, when the company is red hot, it's doing great, everything like that. Now he wants to go in the direction of what bankrupted Gateway, rather than going in the opposite direction of what made Dell successful. Just no stores or anything like that. On top of that, the analysts were really coming down on this idea because Apple is a cool company back then, today, in the future, everything. It's known as being really cool, really creative, everything like that. And that's going to go away if they open up a Radio Shack, if they open up a Best Buy. You know, that's not cool. That's not creative, everything like that. Well, these people did not know Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs says, we're going to do something completely different. We're not going to open a Radio Shack. We're not going to open a Best Buy. So what is it we're going to be doing specifically, though? We're going to do it in a different way, but what is the it that we're doing? What we're doing now is customer service. And he looks to history because all the answers are found in history. I mean, over and over again, I could show you examples and examples and examples. Even this, I didn't bring it up, but one of the reasons... Microsoft, Windows, that was a copy of, they ripped off Apple's Windows designs and everything like that. And Steve Jobs and Bill Gates had a huge falling out over that. Steve Jobs said, oh, Gates, you know, you're stealing our designs and our everything like that. Well, the thing is, Steve Jobs took a lot of his stuff, stole a lot of his stuff from Xerox, which came before him. He got that the interface and everything from that, because why not just learn from history? It's already there, just like with sneakers and everything like that. Look to what's already been done. It's Harry Truman, an American president, very famous American president, said, the only thing new is the history you don't know. The only thing new is the history you don't know. And so this is the type of thing. And why is it called Xerox? It's because it was this new type of process they had. And they named it from the Greek, xerography. They made up this word, Xerox, or something like that, means dry, and graphy means to write. So xerography, because it's not using ink or anything like that. That's not how the photocopier works. It uses light and this other stuff to burn the image onto the paper. That's what's happening. So it's a dry writing, and so they named it that, and then they abbreviated xerography to Xerox. Anyway, so Steve Jobs, he looks to history, and he says, okay, we're doing, in essence, what we're doing now is going to be customer service. So Steve Jobs asks all the people around him, you know, where have you gotten the best customer service you've ever gotten? Where would that be? And I would ask you the same thing. Where would you think you would get the best customer service? I ask the classes, and every semester I explain this, that I explain this. I hope that no one shouts out strip club names or whatever. But you, in your own mind, think, you know, where would you expect the absolute best customer service? And what happens is, every now and then I get people saying, hotels. And really, really, it's at these five-star hotels. That was it. That was the answer that he got. These five-star hotels, these places, they have concierge desks, okay, where that concierge is trained to attend to any need you may have, and they're so highly trained to be attentive to you, they're supposed to attend to needs you don't even realize you have. That's what it is. And they get all, I mean, of course, some of these hotel rooms cost $20,000 a night. They want to keep you happy. That's the main thing. And they get crazy requests. They get all kinds of crazy requests with, I want a purple Ferrari with yellow polka dots. The concierge will get it for you. You have to pay for it, but the concierge will arrange it for you. I want a solid gold statue of myself, 6 inches high, in my room, tucked in with the head on the pillow. The concierge will get it for you. You have to pay for it, but that's what it is. And it's somewhat similar to rock stars and celebrities, where when they go to perform someplace or they go to a talk show or whatever it is, they have what's called a rider, R-I-D-E-R, and they send it ahead of them, their manager does or whoever it does, their list of demands, their list of things that they want. I want a jar of only green M&Ms. Pick out all the others and just have the green M&Ms there for me. Any kind of crazy request or whatever it is. So it's similar to that. Now, you have Steve Jobs puts all his future managers of the Apple stores through the Ritz-Carlton concierge training program. All the first generation Apple store managers went through the Ritz-Carlton concierge training program to teach them how to attend to people's needs. But Apple doesn't call it a concierge desk. What do they call it? They call it a genius bar, as some of you know. They call it a genius bar. Different name, but same dynamic. And the employees, same thing. In other stores, just like a normal business, the employees are trained to get done with the customer as soon as possible. That way you can move on to the next one. You need fewer employees, everything like that. So just get it done with as soon as possible. Get rid of the customer and move on to the next one when they have a question, when they have a concern. But Apple was different. Like the employees of the Ritz-Carlton, they can spend unlimited amounts of time with a customer. Rather than having like a 1 minute limit or 2 minutes or 5 minutes, they can spend 30 minutes without feeling pressured by the manager to make a sale or to move on to another customer or whatever it is. Now, I'm sure a number of you have been to the Apple store, been inside it, everything like that. You've noticed the Genius Bar. But have you noticed the floor? That's another question. Have you noticed the floor? You see, every Apple store actually owns its own floor. It's not like the floors of any other store in that mall. What's going on with that? When Steve Jobs is saying, okay, we need to put these Apple stores on everyone, he's designing them, he says, you know what? I remember when I went on vacation to Italy, and when I was in Florence, now mind you, this was almost 20 years beforehand, but he remembered it, and he said, I really like the color of the stone in those sidewalks. I want that stone for all of our stores. I want that to be the flooring. Now, the board must have said, you mean you want that color, right? That's what you want? No, I want that stone, the actual stone, to be gotten from Florence and shipped over here and put in. And I can only imagine what the board must have been thinking. Oh, this guy's crazy. This guy's nuts. Firstly, who cares about the floor? Secondly, if you really like the color and everything that much, they even said to him, we can stain the concrete, we can color match it exactly, and it will be 50 times cheaper. So it will be 50 times more expensive to get the actual stone than to just stain concrete that color. Steve Jobs says no. So you don't just have to get it, ship it over and everything like that. It all has to be cut into tiles and labeled because the patterns have to match and everything. Steve Jobs just insists on it. And in fact, Apple apparently owns a part of the quarry in that mountain. It doesn't own the whole mountain, but they never want to run out of that stone for their stores because everything has to be consistent. And they have very high quality standards too. They only select certain tiles and everything like that. And apparently each store needs like 500 tiles and they all have to match properly, stuff like that. So to control the selection, to make sure they never run out and everything like that, they apparently own part of that quarry. But hey, it worked. You know, you can't argue with success. You can't question the methods when it yields enormous, gigantic success. Enormously successful. If you see another principle of history, you see the Windows store, you see the Samsung store, they look very similar, don't they? That's because the same theme in history. Once somebody does something really successfully, other people try and copy it. But unlike with knowledge and stuff like that, copying the actual processing graphic user interface that Microsoft copied from Apple and Apple copied from Xerox, when it's something like this, there's another principle of history, often imitated, never duplicated, as was said of Soul Train. I'm probably losing some of you right now, but if maybe we'll do a Soul Train lecture at the very end of the semester if we have time. That's why I brought up that example. Don't worry about it now. Anyway, but often imitated, but never duplicated. It's just not that same thing. It doesn't have that X factor, that je ne sais quoi, whatever you want to call it, that Apple had. And here there are just so many principles that we can extract from these things in any way, in the past, in the present, in the future. I knew this guy from the gym. He was a Marine and he was stationed in Hawaii. And he was stationed there when President Obama, this was years ago as president, he went there to visit Hawaii for some reason. And in the middle of the night, the Marines were backing up the Secret Service as extra security. So in the middle of the night, he gets woken up and goes and joins the Marine detachment backing up the president, because the president, and in the middle of the night, had decided to go and have this thing called tropical snow. So he goes there, has that, and then the Marine, president leaves. Eventually the Marine finishes his tour of duty, comes back to the continental United States, and he decides he wants to open some sort of business. He keeps going around the different banks trying to get a loan, but as I told you before, you really need collateral when you try and get a loan, and he pushed the Marine thing, I serve my country, everything like that. They would not lend him any money. So he had some money saved. He had a good amount of money saved from being in the military. Not a lot. But, before he had left Hawaii, to come back home, he said, you know what? I want to try this thing which the president had gotten up in the middle of the night to have. Maybe it's something special. He tried it and he liked it. So, then he came back. He couldn't get a loan. And he says, you know what, let me check on this tropical snow thing. And, you know, they were selling like carts and everything like that, not exclusive franchises with big kiosks or stores, but these carts. And they were even doing well in the northern areas where it's cold. They were doing fine. So here in the southern areas where it's warm, Hawaii or Miami or anything, it seems like a good idea. So he said, okay, you know, why don't I get one of these carts? And he did, and he wound up doing pretty well with that. And then same dynamic over and over again. These rich guys tried to copy his idea because it's not an exclusive territory. I think CrossFit is still around, you know, and they sell their business model things where you can open your own CrossFit, but there's no exclusivity to it. Like most franchises, like if you work for McDonald's, sir, who's listening right now, you know, you can't open another McDonald's within a certain area of another one. They have exclusive territory. But these rich guys, so they bought a cart and opened right next to him in the same mall courtyard or whatever it is, and tried to compete with him with lower prices to drive him out of business. And then they'll basically have that spot. But it didn't work because they didn't make the tropical snow very well. Their employees weren't trained, whereas he would take 2 hours to train someone how to make the beverage. And you can go further and further into this with the trial and error. You know, I like business and I like military stuff because there the principles tend to be a little more clear. A lot more clear, actually, a lot more. Yes, you can see, okay, don't overextend yourself. It leaves you off balance and vulnerable to a counterattack. You can see it in different areas, but it's really clear in military. It's really clear in business. It's really clear in martial arts. And, you know, he did different things, like rather than this 8 hours a day, 7 days a week or whatever it is, he eventually got other people to run it, you know, when he wasn't there, of course. But he found that just doing festivals, when there's music festivals or whatever it is, he would make just as much money just those few days a month when there was a festival as he did when he was doing every day. In a mall courtyard or something like that. So he found different ways to do things, as we all should, as we can apply these lessons. Yes, you could see if you want to start a business, but really that ability to perceive what's going on, to see opportunity, isn't that applicable in everything we do, every day, all day? Opportunities right there, just waiting for us to take advantage of them, but we have to see them first. We have to notice them first. And also, it's not only opportunities, it's also dangers, problems. Another student of mine, from many years ago, his family, they moved here from the Middle East and everything like that, and they were really into corner stores, basically similar to bodegas. You go there, you can get your milk, you can get your, you know, some grocery, whatever it is. Usually they make, he didn't tell me this, but usually they make all their money on beer, cigarettes, and lottery tickets. But anyway, corner stores, and he would tell me how they look for places to open up. You know, is there a laundromat nearby where people are going to be doing their laundry? What are they going to do? Just stand there watching the washing machine and dryer work? No, they're going to walk around. They're going to come into your store, buy some coffee, buy some food, sandwiches, whatever it is, there you go. So they're really good at this, perceiving these good opportunities, and then they work hard to build it up. They did this in one of the spots they did this. They did it, and that's fine. But the problem is the landlord kept raising the rent every year over and over again. Now, you've all heard the principle. I've often said, you know, taking lemons and making lemonade, but there are many such lessons in history. Another one you may have heard of is killing the goose that lays the golden eggs. What does that mean? It means that going for the short-term benefit and sacrificing all this long-term benefit. I mentioned way back with the Phoenicians, you know, they had this bad land, or maybe I didn't, there's a lot I left out from that one, but they had this bad land. Half their land was good for agriculture. The other half was not really bad, but it wasn't good for growing food. So they only had grass, and so what they did was graze animals. And they chose sheep, partly because that you can keep shearing the wool off over and over again, rather than just killing it, getting the meat, and then what do you have left? So here, this landlord, it seems like, why does he do this? He's short-sighted. That's what it might seem like. Oh, he wants his money and everything like that. And as someone who rents out houses and everything like that that I own, I can tell you, it usually takes time to find a new tenant. And you have to keep paying all these bills and everything, even when it's vacant. And then when you get a new tenant, there's all kinds of expenses involved and hassle and this and that. So this landlord kept raising the rent over and over and over again, this owner of a strip mall. And then that's it. They just said, this is too expensive for us, and they left. But lo and behold, another tenant moved in almost immediately. How did that happen? This rarely happens. You tell me. How did the landlord find a new tenant for that place so quickly? The landlord was the new owner of that corner store that opened up. He saw, oh no, this is a very successful business. He drove these people out once they had built up a clientele and tested the business model, everything like that, redid the inside to hold groceries and everything. And then he opened his own corner store. So lots of lessons here, lots of lessons. And one of them is, oftentimes in life we'll be thinking, whether it's people we know or politicians or whatever it is, oh, these people have no idea what they're doing. They're idiots. Well, a lot of times those people know exactly what they're doing. And that's when you need to really watch out. That's one of those red flags. But and there's further lessons, you know, put ourselves in that position. Say somebody did that to us. All that knowledge we put in, all that expertise, all those long hours, all that sacrifice, only to have it sabotaged and taken over by the person to whom you were paying rent. Now, one of the lessons we learned, okay, it's business. This is how life works. You know, and it's not necessarily being cynical. It's just seeing things the way it's meant to be. We wouldn't walk into a used car dealership and say, oh, can you imagine this salesman actually asked me to pay more than it was really worth? That's how that environment works. Kill or be killed, that type of thing. In business, that's how you really should see it, even if that's not always the case. You see, you know, one military guy who was in my class, famous military guy, retired after like 23 years in the Army, in the military, and he was giving me this example, you know, the police, they come to you, they're questioning you about something, you know, let's say the wife says you put your hands on her and everything, and the cop's going to be putting his arm around your shoulder and saying, oh man, I would have done the same exact thing. Believe me, I sympathize. A woman like her. As soon as the guy says, yeah, that's why I did it, click, handcuffs right on his wrist. Cops are not your friends. It's their job to put you in prison. Even aside from the fact that I have a low opinion of the police in the city, even good police, which I've known some of them, and everything like that, it's their job to put you in prison. They're not your buddy. They're not your friend. You know, taking an extreme example, I didn't go over this part in class, but pioneers in the Old West in America, they didn't name their horses. Why? Here, you guys have pets, you know, at home that you love. You have your horse in the Old West. You know, you get a close bond with that, everything like that. Your only companion, oftentimes, it'll be just you and your horse. Didn't name their horses. Why? In case they had to eat them. That's the thing. This is reality to the second power. Hard struggle. Now, I'm tempted to go deeper into this and go more into this because there are so many lessons just in this type of thing where, you know, okay, let's say that did happen to you. Let's say you got your business taken by this landlord and everything like that. What are you going to do? A lot of people I know would have come back and thrown a brick through the window or even set fire to the place or something like that. Well, you got to think that through. Firstly, who are they going to suspect? Who's going to be doing that? The very first person they're going to suspect is you. Might file a lawsuit, definitely call the police, everything like that. Look at it from a different perspective. What if you did that to someone else? You copy their idea, drove them out of business. Well, they're going to want revenge, and they might not be like you. You know, another lesson from history, people aren't necessarily like us and seeing the world the same way we do. They have very little to lose. They don't care if you sue them. They don't care if they go to jail. They're not even thinking about the future. So you got to be concerned. Are they going to come back with a gun? Are they going to do whatever it is? And so we factor all this stuff in, and maybe we look around elsewhere for different ideas. A lot of successful businesses and a lot of successful ideas, projects, and everything like that have come from, oh, this idea is very successful in some other place. Why don't I just do it here? Let's do that. I had a student a few years back. He finished his mass MBA from FIU. His girlfriend got into medical school in, not in Pittsburgh, but like near Pittsburgh. So it's a small town, and he moves with her, got married and everything like that. And now he's got his MBA, but they're in this small little town, and he doesn't know how he's going to make money. Can't find a job, he's overqualified for all this other stuff, and how's he going to do it? Well, one of the things he did to pay the bills when he was in college here is he, and even his girlfriend at the time, had worked for this fried Oreo place. I've never tried it, but maybe some of you have heard of it or whatever it is. And he said, you know what? He would work for them delivering these things. And he said he looked around up near Pittsburgh, and there was nothing like that there. He said, maybe I can learn to make them, and then I can have that business here, and I can make money that way. And he did that. His first fried Oreos, which he tried to make, turned out pretty terrible. But he tried and failed. And eventually he was making them much better than the ones here. Not just according to him, but according to other people who have had both. His were much better. And he had a business like that, making money. Various things. I can tell you various students I've had. One of them, she had gone on a study abroad to Russia. And she didn't know how she was going to make money. And so what she did was she sublet the place where she was renting and rented it out to other people. So she's renting the place, and then she took rooms and everything in it and rented them out individually. So it wound up she was basically living there for free. And also she would do other things. Oh, Amerikansky! You know, a lot of these Russians want to learn English from a real American. And she would hold these sessions where she would basically kind of teach them English, but basically just speak to them in English and give them her thoughts and everything like that. And she made money that way. Plenty of money to be made, plenty of success to be made, meaning not just in money, not just in business, but in anything we're looking at. So let's look at a modern comparison. When we see, you know, I mentioned the Gilded Age at the very beginning. These so-called robber barons, these super wealthy people who are fantastically, amazingly wealthy. We have a modern comparison, Jeff Bezos of Amazon.com. We have, you know, he is over $100 billion. He got to, and amazingly powerful, the company and influential and everything like that. Let's see what's going on with that. Maybe 6 months ago, you know, I brought this up in a class I was teaching, because right at that time, they had revealed about HQ2. That's what they called it, HQ2. What is that? Well, sometime before that, maybe 2 years ago, I'm just guesstimating, what happened is that Amazon announced that they were going to open a second headquarters. And they called it HQ2, Headquarters 2. And they needed to decide where to have it, where they would locate it in America. Now, this would be a huge, huge thing. Everybody wants businesses to move to their area, but something like this, a second Amazon headquarters? So, Amazon announced to all these major cities, we're going to listen, when you have something to say about why we should go there, submit your proposals to us. We'll be very receptive to it. All these major cities eagerly wanted the headquarters there. So Amazon is soliciting from all these cities. What incentives would you offer us? How much land would you give us? Where? What tax breaks would you offer? What are the demographics? Why should we move there? What is your population like? What is their income level? All as many details as you can provide to make your case will only make your case stronger. So submit all that to us. And again, very eager to try and get Amazon to move there. All these cities were aggressively submitting all this stuff in their proposals. And Amazon eventually narrowed it down to 20 cities, 2-0. And Miami was one of those cities. So a number of us were carefully watching how this was going to play out. Here, if they had moved here, it would have made real estate just shoot up. And other things, you know, business, everything like that. But, and there were quite a few reasons why Miami would be a strong possibility, I would have thought. I mean, here, and other people would have thought if you analyze it, okay, their headquarters is in Seattle, all the way on the other corner, the northeast corner of the country. Now you could get the northwest corner, excuse me, of the country. Now you could get the southeast corner, and you could get excellent coverage of the whole country. You have South and Central America are huge markets for Amazon, and here you could not only be close to those markets, you could also find people who are fluent, naturally fluent in Spanish, everything like that, as opposed to people who just took high school Spanish, things like that. There were a number of reasons why it would be conducive for Bezos to have his company, his second headquarters here, especially because, as some of you know, Jeff Bezos went to which high school? Palmetto. Jeff Bezos, he's our most famous graduate, and here, you know, they always say, oh, you know, Jeff Bezos went here. Although Jeff Bezos, I sometimes wonder if he's somehow saying, ah, Flynn Martins, he's in Miami. You know, two roughly equally important and successful individuals, each recognizing each other. Jeff Bezos is wealthy in material goods, but I'm rich in love. Finally, they made the announcement, and it was actually a little bit surprising because not only was it not Miami, which was not surprising, but it was actually split into two different locations. One was Arlington, Virginia, and the other was Long Island, New York. Now, on one of the major news networks, they had an expert on. He had been on a dozen different corporate boards, been on four different headquarters searches. He said this thing of Amazon's was not a contest, it was a con. And he said in all his experience and everything like that, that actually it's not all these different factors and whatever. There's really only one criteria that determines where the location is going to be. And that is where the CEO wants to spend most of his time. That's it. Whether the CEO is chairman of a golf course, or his wife or future wife lives there, or his mistress lives there, or whatever it is, that is really the only criteria involved. So the Bezos, they own three homes, all three within 7 miles of one of the spots which was chosen for the headquarters. So this was inevitable, it was going to be that. There was other location factors, like Jeff Bezos owned the Washington Post, and he wants to be close to that headquarters. That Virginia area, right next to Washington, D.C. And not only does he have his paper there, he wants to be close to where the decisions get made, close to power, close to the powerful people, so he can exercise influence over them. that's one of the reasons why he bought the newspaper, the Washington Post. And it's some big money involved, even the salaries, they say. Now, of course, you always exaggerate and inflate these things when you're trying to sell the idea and trying to get people to want your headquarters there. But they said the average salary will be $150,000 a year for in that HQ2. And I tend to believe it, you know, because it's big money involved, very big money with these companies. Of course, the average workers are making far less than that in the warehouses and everything like that, making $15 an hour. And that's only because it just got bumped up. And that's after pressure from people like Bernie Sanders. So, and even that, to get that pay when they raised it to $15 an hour, they took away bonus pay and pay for achievements and stuff like that. So some of the people are making even less than they did before they raised the wages. Now, the reason this expert was saying it's a con is because it was 238 cities total, different cities, that got this false hope, and they spent all this time and money and effort collecting all this data to do the proposal. And really, that's what, guess what the most important thing to all these internet companies is, whether it be Facebook or Amazon or whatever it is, the thing they live and breathe and everything like that is data. Data. Now, there's always these issues when these companies try and collect it. It's how are they going to collect it? How are they going to get people to volunteer it? How are they going to avoid legal issues with the collection, privacy issues with the collection? How are they going to ensure the accuracy? Are people telling them the truth? Everything like that. But here, Amazon got gigantic amounts of data, information on future and current customers, huge amounts from all over the country, all these major areas. They got it handed to them from the government, so they know it's authentic, everything like that. No privacy issues, no legal issues. And what was the best part? They got it for free. It's really, really smart. And there's a reason this guy, Jeff Bezos, has over $100 billion. And there's more stuff. Just like every, you know, really clever thing or what it's doing, multiple things that we don't even realize. This expert on the news gave this example of charitable auctions. Okay, maybe you've heard of them, but I'm sure you can imagine it. There's some charitable cause. Save the Spotted Owls, or save the Everglades, something like that. And they get some famous person to auction off as taking people to dinner. People will bid on the chance to go to dinner with this person or whatever it is. Let's say dinner. And it might be, you know, it's not going to be somebody like Dwayne Wade or somebody super famous, but it's going to be a famous guy, an NBA player. It wouldn't be Jay-Z, but it might be Pitbull, somebody like that. And there'll be, you know, this bidding war. Oh, okay, dig deep into your pockets. Bid. Who will win this great thing? And usually there'll be two people fighting it out in the bidding war, on and on and on. Who will win? And then once one of them wins, the announcer will say, you know what? You guys are so enthusiastic and you want it so much. Our guest is willing to have dinner with both of you. And after all that bidding war, hyping the price up, the guest, whoever it was, Pitbull or whoever, is going to have dinner with both of them, and they'll get both the amounts of money. That's what Bezos and Amazon did. After all this playing one against the other, these hundreds of cities, getting them to compete aggressively, oh no, we'll offer you this, we'll offer you this, that, everything like that, what does he finally do? Now he's going to get the tax incentives and land and everything from both, even though he's only bringing half the stuff to the table. But he's not going to say to them, oh, you know, let's be fair here. We're only bringing half the amount of jobs, half the amount of construction, everything like that. Just give us half the amount of incentives. He's not going to say that. It reminds me of this artist, Giotto. I think his name is spelled G-I-O-T-T-O, Giotto. And there's this very famous anecdote about him. This is a true story. You know, the Catholic Church would solicit from the different artists, they would offer a commission to do whatever, some sculpture, some painting, or whatever it is. And as an interview to test people's ability, they would send someone to collect the best artwork. You know, you will make something up to show your abilities and submit it to the church. And, you know, whoever has the best one, they will get the job. Now, Giotto, what did he do? Did he do some gigantic fresco or anything like that? What he did when the collection person came around, Giotto just drew a circle freehand and gave it to him. And he got the commission. Now, this has always been said as, oh, you know, simplicity and skill. He drew a perfect circle freehand. And as much as I like that kind of thing, as much as I admire, you know, that this whole movie Sphere, it has that anecdote in it. That's not what really happened. Most people, even artists and art history people maybe art history people even would think that's the case. But what really happened is Giotto knew this was firstly, it was kind of arrogant, but he knew he was the best and he was going to get the commission. Why the church was doing that is because it would collect all these best pieces from all these great artists and the church got to keep them. So Giotto knew, you know, this is just a way to get a bunch of free artwork. Also, he knew that he was good enough. So he didn't want to be exploited. He didn't want to be giving away his stuff for free. And again, you can relate this, for example, the Bezos Amazon thing to so many things in history, in our current events, in our own day-to-day lives, everything like that. There are these issues about too big to fail. And many would argue if it's too big to fail, that means it's too big. Now, this was really applied to when there was a financial crisis and these big banks were on the brink of failure. But even with Amazon, you know, is it a monopoly? Is it a trust? Is it all these types of things which maybe we should break up or at least watch out for? So all these things, the awareness and whatnot. Now, let me break this. Yeah, this is a good place to stop. Okay.